Dr. Satan.
HPPodcast.com.
Business was being done as usual in the big outer office of the Ryan Importing Company. Calls came over the switchboard for various department heads. Men and girls bent over desks, reading and checking order blanks, typewriting, performing the thousand and one duties of big business. Yet over the office hung a hush, more sensed than consciously felt. The typewriters seemed to make less than their normal chatter. Employees talked in low tones when they had something to communicate to one another. The office boy showed a tendency to tiptoe when he carried a fresh batch of mail in from the anteroom.
That was the opening of Dr. Satan. Wow. Dr. Satan is a story by Paul Ernst.
Even though the title suggests some kind of medical drama in hell.
No.
No, friends, this is a detective story. And we know that because of the detective trope right there in the beginning. It's in every story of this type. Detective comes into the office after a crime is committed. First thing he or she asks, how was the office boy acting? Was there a tendency to tiptoe? If he tiptoes all the time, that's not news. I'm asking, did he tiptoe differently, like every third step, or only in a certain direction? A tendency, you see. Happy New Year, Chris.
Happy New Year. I know this is actually the second show of the year.
And we probably said on the last show, Happy New Year, but guess what? That was a lie.
Yeah.
Because we recorded it last year.
Yeah, in December. So we had no idea if there would even be a new year.
We didn't know at the time.
But there is a new year. So Happy New Year.
Specifically to this group.
Yeah.
Our beloved patrons, you get the honest New Year, the authentic one. Here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories. And for just a little while longer, the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lanke. That reader was Eric Peabody. We thought if anybody could deliver a story called Dr. Satan, it would be him.
Eric is the satanic mastermind behind Viking Guitar Productions. If you're making music, podcasts, audiobooks, you're going to want to circle him in. And by that, I mean draw a circle on the ground, keep him within it.
Yes.
Talk about your project, get the work done, never break the circle.
We'll link out to Viking Guitar in the show notes. Thank you, Eric.
Now, our last show, The Anne Rice Story, Rambling Gate, it was good. But I gotta admit, it was kind of a bummer. Like, I felt bad the rest of the day after we recorded it.
Yeah.
Obviously, because we were marking the loss of the author. And so over the holidays, which were sort of a bummer anyway, I had time to do some reading. I thought, I gotta do some stuff that's gonna cheer me up. I consulted my weird pulp compilations. And I picked some stories just based on the title that I thought would have good ideas and or make me laugh. Let me tell you something. I did not disappoint myself. In
Yay.
Fact, I knocked it out of the park. Yeah, it was a victory for me, and I want to share this victory with everybody.
Let's get into Dr. Satan.
Yes.
This story was from the August 1935 issue of Weird Tales, and it had a kick-ass cover illustration that spawned seven Dr. Satan follow-up stories.
Years ago, I was just scanning Weird Tales covers, and obviously this jumped out at me because of the title, Sugar on Top of Sugar, Dr. Satan, and then the image itself, we'll link out to it, but it's a guy in a devil costume. He's counting money over an arcane book, and there's a candle burning on a skull next to him. The funny part of the image is he's sort of looking at the viewer like he's been caught on camera doing this, but not by paparazzi or detective. It's like a grimace, like his mother's there going, Dr. Satan, just let me get a photo of you with your new money.
Weird Tales fans didn't like this story. They got hate mail every time they published one of these saying that fans didn't want it going in this kind of pulpy direction.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I read, that they hated it, but yet there's seven of them.
Yeah.
So I thought, why did they keep doing this? So I looked it up. The whole thing was a response to competition. The pioneering magazine was Dime Mystery Magazine. It was so successful because the formula of its stories were weird horror paired with detective stories. Most of the stories were pretty straightforward pulp formula where a weird and horrible crime is committed, oftentimes seeming to be a sort of supernatural thing. A detective hero would investigate, solve the crime just in time to save the beautiful heroine. The stories featured a goodly amount of sadism, some minor sex and lust, and a lot of fast action. The magazines did extremely well and lured a certain proportion of readers from Weird Tales, a major problem faced by editor Farnsworth Wright. Drastic action was called for. The most ambitious of his efforts was the Dr. Satan series, written by Paul Ernst. Dr. Satan stories were out-and-out weird fantasies with both villain and hero, both being masters of super science and black magic. Wright had high hopes for this series. He wrote, "We await with eager interest your verdict on the stories about Dr. Satan. To those of you who are afraid that Weird Tales will degenerate into just another detective magazine, we definitely promise that it will not do so." Wright was correct in stating that the Dr. Satan stories were weird. Ernst filled them with one supernatural event after another, even having his characters fighting in the afterlife. However, while the series did have its admirers, it wasn't popular enough. Like you said, most people didn't like it, so after that it was cut. The series has no resolution. Dr. Satan was never caught. Oh, that's chilling.
I'm not going to sleep tonight.
Uh-uh.
Now, we've never talked about Paul Ernst before, or at least never covered any of his stories. Maybe we randomly mentioned him, possibly. But he was born in Akron, Ohio in 1899. He got started in the pulps in his 20s. As a writer for Weird Tales, Astounding Stories, Strange Tales, and Amazing magazine. He's known for writing superhero stories, specifically a guy called The Avenger. There's 23 novel-length stories about The Avenger.
Wow.
The Avenger's like a superhero kind of dude, like Doc Savage and The Shadow combined. And he didn't actually create this character, even though he wrote these stories. Supposedly, Kenneth Robeson, the guy that created Doc Savage, created this character. And he actually Ernst did all the writing for these stories. Now, when the pulp started drying up, he transitioned to Slick magazines and was writing as late as 1971 for Good Housekeeping. But he passed away in 1985 at the age of 85, so that's a pretty good stretch. Our story begins at an importing business. The office is busy, but something is going on.
We swing into this story with a strong passive sentence. Business was being done as usual.
The boss, Arthur B. Ryan, has a headache, and that's strange. Everybody's on edge about this headache.
He came in fine in the morning, but by 10, he was howling and complaining and asking for medicine.
Then they hear a scream and go in to find Arthur Ryan is dead, but not normal dead, horrifying strange dead.
The sales manager staggers out of the office. "A tree growing out of his head," he gasped. "A tree pushing out of his skull like a plant cracking a flower pot it outgrows and sending roots and branches through the cracks."
A day that made criminal history in New York. So now we cut to a house in Long Island that belongs to Samuel Billingsley, another rich guy.
Remember that name. It's very important. Just like the last guy. Remember those names.
He's got two armed guards at his gate. His nephew, Merton, has shown up to see his uncle, but it seems that he's had a headache today.
Through the golden summer sunlight, like jagged lightning impinging on the eardrums instead of the optic nerves, a scream lanced out. I mean, can't relate?
It's so confusing. They hear the scream from the house. Merton has guards jump on the running boards of his car, which I think is pretty cool. They speed to the house.
Why do I get so... I guess it must be wish fulfillment that I really want to jump on a running board, which is why anytime that happens in any form of entertainment, I'm excited. I even like it when someone jumps on a garbage truck. Because it's enough like that.
It is pretty exciting. I agree. The doctor, Smythe, is horrified as he comes down the stairs. He explains that Uncle Samuel has had a thorn bush grow out of his head.
I was reading this in a scan of the original Weird Tales. And even then, I still flipped back to make sure I was still reading Dr. Satan. You know, did I skip to another story or something? Because it just... How does this have anything to do, you know, this tree thing to do with Dr. Satan? I assumed it would start with something satanic. Although I guess this is a medical case.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So it's related in that respect.
But is Dr. Satan a medical doctor? I thought he just had his PhD in some kind of liberal arts degree or something.
It's hard to know with him because, as we'll find out, he's an expert at a lot of things.
At a lot of things. Now, Merton, of course, thinks the doctor has lost his mind, and he pushes past him despite the doctor telling him that he shouldn't look. It's too horrifying. And, of course, he finds his uncle dead with a tree growing out of his head.
A sort of bush with leafless, sharp, pointed twigs branching out in all directions grew from the top of the skull. It was like a hand with many small, sharp fingers that had thrust up through the bone, with its thick, wrist-like stem rooting in the brain beneath.
Whew, that seems like a pretty terrible way to go.
That finally wraps up our intro. Chapter 2, we're in the Park Avenue penthouse in the library where there's all kinds of science and psychology and occult books. There's a big ebony desk with a man at the desk and a man across from him. The visitor is a 50-something business guy named Ballard Wallstead. And Wallstead is afraid of something. Full of fear, I tell you.
Fear!
The guy at the desk is our protagonist, Ascot Keene. And here's a description of him. He was a big man, but supple and quick-moving. His eyes, deep under coal-black eyebrows, were light gray. They looked calm as ice, as if no emergency could disturb their steely depths.
His eyes? Pff, what do you think, they're blue or green or something? Weak like that? Steely and gray!
Now, Wallstead has come to Keene for help, since he has heard Keene is more than a dilettante, and that he studied crime and the black arts, and he has a reputation among certain circles.
He is the exact hero you would come up with when you're a 10-year-old boy.
Now, it seems Wallstead got a note saying, pay up $1 million or die. The note says, you will disregard this as a note from a crank, of course, but by noon tomorrow you will know better. You see, I have given two other men, Arthur B. Ryan and Samuel Billingsley, a choice similar to yours, and I believe they are going to defy me.
Those name memorizations just paid off, by the way.
Totally. Read the afternoon papers. What happens to them, Wallstead? And believe me when I say that the same thing will happen to you if you do not meet my price. Directions will be given to you tomorrow noon as to where and how you will pay the money. Your obedient servant, Dr. Satan.
Ooh, very Phantom of the Opera with the obedient servant bit.
Unfortunately, Wallstead can't get the money together in time, and he's freaking out. Keene asks if anybody went near him today, if he was touched or bumped by anybody, and Wallstead's, yes, actually I bumped into somebody, and the guy apologized to me, but I didn't get a good look at him because I didn't think anything of it. Keene tells Wallstead to go home, and then he'll be in touch, and Wallstead, he's a little bothered because he's really scared about this. And he says, I want protection. I want to stay here. And Keene says, look, I'm going to go after Dr. Satan. You're not going to be any safer here than you would be at your own place. And after that, Wallstead leaves. Keene calls out, Beatrice! And one of the bookshelves moves to reveal a hidden room, and out comes a woman.
She was tall and beautifully formed, with dark blue eyes and hair that was more red than brown.
Beatrice is his girl Friday, and she's cross at him for making Wallstead leave in his time of need. And Keene reveals that, look, I can't help that guy. He's going to be dead real soon, and we can't have him dying in the office because the cops would come and they'd start asking too many questions.
So cold, ass guy Keene.
That's really cold.
He just goes, I kind of think that by being jostled, he's dead already, so I'm just not even going to make an effort. He doesn't call a doctor or anything.
Yes, there is a lot of assumptions made in this story that always seem to be right. Now, Keene says to Beatrice that Dr. Satan must know that Wallstead can't pay. How does he know that he doesn't know that he can't pay?
Well, I think he reasons that if Dr. Satan can make plants grow from people's heads, he probably can check out their finances as well.
Okay, sure. Keene deduces that Dr. Satan's plan is to kill him as well as the other guys to make an example. Because once people know that Dr. Satan can kill you, that they're going to start giving him the money that he wants.
I think that Dr. Satan right away is showing us how badass he is by breaking the rule of threes. Because he's killed two guys. That should be enough to prove a point to a third, but nope. He's going to kill three guys to extort a fourth.
So Beatrice says that Dr. Satan isn't someone she's heard of, and Keene confirms that he's new on the scene. Keene gets up and starts pacing, thinking of his next move, when all of a sudden his chair combusts in blue flame. Quickly, the chair is nothing more than a pile of ash, and Keene says, I don't know about Dr. Satan yet, but apparently he knows a great deal about me. One of his guys, Rice, comes in and tells Keene that Wallstead has just died downstairs in the lobby, tree and ahead.
This thing that he knows a great deal about is that he has a chair in his office? I didn't even understand what happened, because it was so random. The way he avoided it was by pacing. I didn't get that thrill of near death as if a snake had been in there or a swinging pendulum or something.
There's no indication, no hint, no suspense, really. Just kind of an event. No. But we get a little explanation here in Chapter 3. We peek into the world of Dr. Satan. We find him in a curtained room over an altar-like table.
The figure looked like one robed for a costume ball, save that in every line of it was a deadliness that robbed it of all suggestions of anything humorous or social. Tall and spare, it was covered by a blood-red robe. Red rubber gloves swathed the hands. The face was concealed behind a red mask that curtained it from forehead to chin with only two black eyes, like live coals, showing through the eye holes. Lucifer. And to complete the medieval portrait of the archfiend, two horned red projections showed above the red skullcap that hid the man's hair.
So it's a full face mask. This isn't the half mask on the cover of the issue.
No.
Which I think supports my theory that he pulled the bottom of the mask, the bottom half of it off, because his mom told him he had to smile.
At the table, he has a small blue flame and it's dying out. And behind him are two minions, creatures like gargoyles, it says. The first was legless, with his great gorilla-like head set on tremendous shoulders, coming up only to a normal man's waist. The second was a wizened small monkey of a man with bright, cruel eyes peering out from a mat of hair that covered all of his features. And the third guy was a younger man, his name's Monroe. Dr. Satan says that Keen has escaped the blue flame, that if it would have turned red, this blue flame would have turned red on his desk if it had consumed a person, but it did not turn red, so it means he missed.
Yeah.
Monroe asks Dr. Satan how he controls the blue flame, and he explains that it was from ancient Egyptian scroll. Normally, one needs something of the person to target them, like their hair or nail clipping, but the most Dr. Satan was able to get was a bit of his chair in his office. Keen is too clever not to leave fingernail clippings or hair out because he knows of their mystical significance.
That means that Ascot Keen is methodically cleaning up after himself everywhere he goes to avoid being witched up. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But he didn't, it says he escaped the blue flame a couple of times. He just stood up and paced.
Yeah.
They introduced the Ascot like, he's handsome. He's an expert at everything. Extremely blasé about the deaths of people who have begged him for help. But he also must live with being incredibly lucky. I'm on Dr. Satan's team.
The death tree, how does he make that happen? Dr. Satan explains that with his botanical skill, he has altered an Australian thorn bush so that it would grow within 2 hours inside a person's brain. Its seed is so small that it floats in the air into the nasal passage. Dr. Satan has the botanical skills to come up with this? To make a plant grow to full size in 2 hours?
Yeah.
He could end world hunger.
He could.
And I'm sure you can make a little money doing that, and you wouldn't have to kill rich guys to do that. I guess that wouldn't be as much fun.
Well, he doesn't even need the money. He's another millionaire who's bored with his life, and that's why he's extorting money from people.
Yeah.
Just killing these people needlessly. It's also funny how just being an Australian thorn bush, that seems like that's the explanation what this plan is. It's very specific on that part.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, it's an Australian thorn bush. And then the second half of the explanation is this. With a certain botanical skill, I altered it into a thing that flowers in 2 hours or less, rooting in a man's brain. The only drawback is that the seed, a tiny thing that floats in air, must be inhaled by the victim to lodge in the nasal passage and later work its way up into the brain. So the only drawback is a perfect delivery system.
Monroe asks, why not kill Ryan and Walstead with the blue flame? Because that works pretty well. You know, that's a pretty solid thing. But Dr. Satan says that wouldn't send a message like the tree would. It wouldn't? Why not?
I know. Seems like you're doing kind of a poison ivy deal right now. You should do the blue flame. That's very Dr. Satan-y.
He's off brand. We also see that Dr. Satan has a drawer full of money. $1 million in bundles. Already his plan is born fruit because he has extorted this from a fourth rich guy.
Right.
So Monroe is weirded out that Dr. Satan is telling him everything, like giving him all these details. So he suspects something is up. And he tells Dr. Satan that he knows a lot about him. I know your real name. I know your family. I know you're rich and you're bored. And I've set up an insurance policy with my lawyer that if anything happens to me, my lawyer will send all of this information to the police. Dr. Satan then instantly hypnotizes Monroe. You're getting sleepy. I'm sleepy. You're now hypnotized. I'm now hypnotized. Done. And he goes, Monroe, what are your plans? And Monroe says, I'm going to totally betray you.
Hypnosis powers? And extreme wealth? Who would have ever thought Dr. Satan would be this over the top?
We find that the monkey man is called Gurse, and the legless giant is called Bostiff, because Dr. Satan tells them to bring out the coffin. Dr. Satan orders Monroe into the coffin. It's an iron coffin. And he takes a bit of Monroe's hair. Bostiff puts the lid on, and Dr. Satan does his thing and sets up the blue flame. This time, his blue flame has a flash of red, and all that's left of Monroe is a pile of ash.
Yeah, well, that all that's left of his hair is a pile of ash. The end of the metal coffin showing from the niche was suddenly red hot, then glowed with white incandescence. Slowly it faded to deep, hot red in color, and back to black. Kind of a cool villain death machine. Doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense since he can hypnotize him to get into the coffin that he would then take the second step of doing sorcery.
Yeah.
I mean, either the Chia Pet thing or this coffin furnace blue flame deal might have been enough for its own story.
Dr. Satan turns to his cronies and he says, Ascot Keen needs to be taken care of. Keen is now going to seek me out and then we will trap him.
It's a trap.
It's a trap. Now, chapter 4 sees us with Beatrice and Keen. Keen is in front of a mirror doing special makeup effects on himself to make himself look just like Wallstead.
Master disguise.
Master disguise on top of it. This is another part where I get a bit confused on the thinking here. He says that Dr. Satan probably knows Wallstead is dead. However, he's going to go through with the money drop anyway because Dr. Satan will then see through this gambit and then capture him. Because he thinks that Dr. Satan will not think that he realizes that he knows.
That's right. Dude, he's playing 666 dimensional chess.
Yes, I know.
That's how you got to play with Doc Satan.
It's crazy. However, if Dr. Satan knows Wallstead is dead, why would he send a guy to pick up the money?
They're all going to play the game. He says he'll see the man. He'll know the man who looks like Wallstead. Can't possibly be Wallstead. He'll know it's me. So then he'll send someone, he'll play along and he'll send someone to get me. I want him to underestimate me. So I am rather stupidly disguising myself as Wallstead and going to the place where Wallstead was to have gone in the hope that Dr. Satan will trap me. I think he'll be sorry, but Dr. Satan has been wanting to do this anyway. So each one thinks he's trapping the other one. It's traps within traps.
I'm not going to think about it too much. It was a little clumsy, but, you know, what do I know?
With what they've set up so far, it was the only organic way for this to work. Everything in the story happens sort of organically.
Yeah, yeah. When he's done, Keen looks just like Wallstead, in appearance as well as manner. But before he leaves, he goes over to his occult jar by his occult scrolls and takes out a greenish paste, touches his forehead, the soles of his shoes, and the palms of his hands. He mentions the blue flame and the Egyptians, so it seems pretty obvious that this is going to be some kind of protection against the blue flame.
In order to be victorious, Ascot has to reach deep down and discover that he already owns the green paste he needs to win. As I said, very organic. It's almost obvious that that would be the solution.
Yeah.
At the top, tree grows out of a businessman's head. I was like, let me guess. All solved with green paste in a flame coffin? I've read this one before.
Tale as old as time. Ascot, in disguise, goes to the drop-off point down in the hustle and bustle of Broadway and 76th Street. He drops the package and keeps walking. Then he quickly hides and watches what happens. The garbage can that he dropped it in begins to empty as if something opened a hole underneath it and is sucking everything out.
Keen shook his head a little, eyes gleaming like ice. Transmission of substance through empty air, he breathed. Which apparently is what happened.
Yeah.
Like a Star Trek transporting machine, there actually was a hole in space-time that opened up there, and these things went through the hole.
Yeah.
I thought that at first Ascot just had no object permanence. That was going to be his one weakness, because it seemed like a pretty obvious magic trick, like there was a false bottom underneath the trash can.
That's what I thought, too.
That was too easy a solution. No, it actually did transfer through space somehow.
An odd man takes Keen's notice, and Keen begins to follow him. Now, is this Dr. Satan or Dr. Satan's henchman? We're not sure. After he follows him a bit, Keen's body begins to tighten up, and he tries to stop himself from walking, but he can't. He's compelled to walk. And then his vision begins to go black, but he's still walking, so he can feel his body walking. Somebody has taken over his body.
It's almost like Dr. Satan could just walk Ascot off into traffic or off a bridge or make him shoot himself, considering that he has 100% mind control over him. But the scary thing is, why isn't he doing it?
Oh,
What's the plan?
Whew. I got goosebumps if you could see my arms right now. He feels himself moving through the city, touching a railing at one point, going down steps. A door slams behind him and he hears a soft voice and he knows it's Dr. Satan.
Slowly, Keen's eyesight returned to him to telegraph to his mind weird nightmare pictures. Black draped walls closed him in. Lounging against one wall were two men. A man with a giant's torso and no legs, and a creature with a hairy, ape-like face in which were set bright, cruel little eyes. Across from them was a metal brazier set on a high tripod, in which a small flame flickered. In the center of the room was a metal table, bare save for a small pinch of yellowish powder. And over this table was bending the man who had spoken, a figure that set the blood to leaping in Keen's veins as his heart thudded with sudden acceleration in his breast. A tall figure, robed in red, with a red mask over his face, red gloves on his hands, and a red skullcap, from which protruded small, mocking imitations of Satan's horns. Dr. Satan turned from the metal table. His black eyes burned at Keen through the eyeholes of his red mask. "Welcome, Ascot Keen," came sardonic words. "We are honored that you should have gone to such trouble to visit us in our modest lair."
And we have a little supervillain banter. Seems Dr. Satan knew that Keen was out to stop him, that he could read Keen's mind for a bit, until Keen put up some sort of psychic defenses.
The funny thing is, this month we're going to be like, oh, finally, a plot that makes sense. And we're going to be talking about Manimal.
Yeah. Keen explains that the son of a friend of his was an unsavory sort of person. Since Keen can read minds as well, he caught a glimpse of Dr. Satan in the young man's mind. And that young man? Monroe?
It was Monroe, so he got information there by reading his mind.
He says, "I got a hint of the man's background and his motives. A rich man, still young, jaded with purchased thrills, with no more humanity in his heart than a snake, out to become the world's leading criminal. A man whose whimsical choice of a name, Dr. Satan, could not have been more apt in expressing his purpose. A sleek beast playing a monstrous game, a thing to be stamped out as soon as possible." Dr. Satan says that he didn't know much about me at the time, so I'm not worried when you read his mind. "I also killed him and made sure his lawyer will never be able to tell anybody Dr. Satan's secrets."
Some papers he left behind with his lawyer have been destroyed within the hour. So that earlier threat, not a threat at all. Mm-mm. We don't know, did the underlings pull a heist? Did he just mentally explode them? Probably the latter.
Probably.
Didn't matter.
Dr. Satan tells Bostiff to get the iron coffin while Dr. Satan hypnotizes Keen into getting inside of the box. Keen moves into the box and lies down. Bostiff goes to put to move the box, and Dr. Satan says, "No, leave it. I want to watch." So he plucks a hair from Keen, and then he goes to his table. He lights the blue flame. He's going to blue flame him. Oh, no. He does the spell. A super hot blue flame appears in the coffin, turns the iron box white hot. And then Dr. Satan says, "And so ends Ascot Keen, the one obstacle in my path. I can be a king, an emperor now in time." Dr. Satan sends Bostiff and Gurse away. But then, out of the box comes only a slightly singed Keen. His counterspell worked.
Brought to you by Green Paste.
He says what the Egyptians discovered, they rendered fruitless by succeeding discoveries. "I read the origin of your blue flame in your first attempt on my life, Dr. Satan, and I took the precaution of using as armor some of the green paste the old priest used against the consuming fires of their enemies."
His key insight is that the ancients created spells, but they were also innovators. So anything that they created, they also created a way to undo it. You know, I didn't bother defending myself from your hypnosis or total control of my body. Mm-hmm. But I figured out this green paste thing in case he tried to burn my chair again.
I'm going to actually defend Keen here. He didn't know he could do hypnosis. All he knew about was the blue flame and the tree in the head.
Oh, man, I got burned down just Wow.
Keen says, "You should have been watching your flame and not watching me, because you would have noticed that it didn't turn red. Ha! In your face!" And then we get a little tough guy talk.
Yeah.
"Now we are alone, Dr. Satan. You have considerately sent your men away, as I hoped you would. We'll see if your powers are as strong as you think they are." Ooh, it's going on now.
Oh, dear.
So Keen puts up his hand, and a yellow aura begins to glow around Dr. Satan, like some kind of shell that he can't break out of. And it seems Keen now has Dr. Satan. But guess what? No, Dr. Satan has got power of his own, and he breaks the aura holding him. The shoe is on the other foot yet again. Strange duel between two titans, two men who probably knew more of nature's dark secrets than any others on Earth. odd battle with Keen, the force of good, gradually being beaten down by the force of evil. Keen is pushed to the ground by an unseen force. He's having trouble breathing. He's out of breath. He's gonna die. He's gonna pass out. No! He lifts his arms up and says, Mother of God, he is overcoming Dr. Satan. But then Dr. Satan puts out the lights and he says, this time you preserve your life. Next time, you leave your life behind.
Whoa, finally we get Dr. Satan's weakness, his threats, terribly worded. Too confusing to scare me. But I guess a little dusting of Christianity on Keen's supernatural magic helped him win the day.
I guess
against so. Against Dr. Satan.
Would make
sense.
So
that's sense. A little on brand.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
The lights come back on, and of course, Dr. Satan is gone. Keen quickly runs outside to the street, trying to hunt him down.
Cursing softly, he looked up and down the sidewalk. There was, of course, no sign of the red-clad figure. Dr. Satan had made good his escape, and with him had gone $1 million, fruit of his first fantastic crime. Keen's wide shoulders sagged, but only for a moment. Then they straightened. The first round was Dr. Satan's, but there would be another time. And then, knowing a little more of the manner of being he was pitted against, he could fight more effectively and win.
Whew, that's the end of the story. It's bad. It's pretty poorly written and it's not very well paced, but man, there's some cool stuff in there and it's kind of fun and I'm sort of compelled to read more.
The Megapack folks have a Dr. Satan Megapack. That's where I found it. It's $1. I leaned heavily on those Megapacks this month. Blood for the Vampire Dead is in the Pulp Fiction Megapack,
mm-hmm.
and Batman is in the Weird Crime Megapack. So if folks want to read those stories, can't find them online, you can check in those, which are great books.
Yeah, and steal. I mean, you get a lot of stories for a dollar, so it's like, come on.
Absolutely.
Now, like I said, there are 8 Dr. Satan stories in total. In future stories, he uses reanimated corpses. At one point, he uses a ray gun that turns skin transparent. I gotta know more. Yeah. How is that useful in any way besides grossing people out? And lots of other kookiness. And Chad, you'll be pleased to know that it's all in the public domain. So I believe maybe a screenplay is going to be in the future.
Well, if we follow the pattern of last year, you know, we read The Colossus of Elorn right at the beginning, and then, no, I'm not going to do that. There's not any way at all. I'm not going to do it. I'm sorry. We do have some radio dramas planned this year, but I don't think they're going to be based on any of the stories.
No.
But for now, we're going to have to close this out. Before we do that, I want to once again thank our reader, Eric Peabody.
Oh my God, he's so good. If you need any kind of audio services, we use him. He's great. Go on over to Viking Guitar. It's a magical site and a magical man. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you for reading Dr. Satan. And I also want to thank our patrons. I've got a selection of them here. I'm going to start by thanking Podcast by Night.
Ooh, that's good. I'd like to thank Micah Champion.
I'd like to thank Quantum Chaos.
I'd like to thank Maria Cicchetti.
I'd like to thank Deborah A. Wickline.
I'd like to thank Matthew Alsop.
Magic Thighs, thank you so much.
Oh, Magic Thighs. I'd like to thank Joel Cooper.
James Kundart, thank you.
And lastly, Michael Moss, thank you so much for your support.
We'll be back with Blood for the Vampire Dead. That's it for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.